Here he smiled and reminded me of the pantomimic conversation without words carried on at the time of our first meeting in the desert, adding, "It was of the utmost importance that I test your ability to send out and to receive telepathic messages. As an outcome of that, you are here now. We know well the skepticism of the Earth people in all directions outside of the narrow ruts of personal experience. It was for this reason that the messages I gave you were of a universal character. We knew that, although the understanding of such writings was buried with civilizations that were lost long ago, there are a few people scattered about your present world who would be able to translate them. With such translations, only the determinedly incredulous can still refuse to believe. It is fortunate," Kalna said, with her merry smile, "that at least mental telepathy has been accepted as an established fact by the scientists of your world. You know," Orthon said, "we had you under observation for some years before I finally contacted you, and we felt sure that your knowledge of telepathy would be adequate. This was proven in the final test at our first meeting." "Did you test me in other ways as well?" I asked. "Indeed we did. You see, inasmuch as you had been photographing our craft for several years, your thoughts were inevitably coming our way. We felt the sincerity of your interest. It remained to be seen if and how you would translate this interest into action, how well you could stand up under the ridicule and skepticism bound to come your way, and whether you would be tempted to use your contacts with us for self-aggrandizement or commercialism. You have passed all the tests with flying colors," Almuth said warmly. "In the face of all the derision, disbelief, even when the validity of your photographs was challenged, we saw how staunch you remained to that which, within yourself, you knew to be true. This encouragement filled me with happiness, and I knew that, with such friends, any faltering would be impossible. There was another thing, too, which we had to know," said Ram, "in regard to your discretion and judgment. For example, there were certain things which the Master revealed to you tonight which, as he made clear, must not yet be told to your people. In a world like yours, it is a great temptation for most men to make themselves important by indulging in attention-getting statements. Moreover, the whole of what is now permissible for you to tell cannot, with wisdom, be told to all. This is where your good judgment enters. After all, you have devoted the better part of your life to teaching universal law insofar as you knew it. In doing so, you learned well that it is not only useless, but often dangerous, to give more knowledge than can be absorbed or understood. We know that you will apply this principle to the information you receive from us. In regard to telepathy," I said, voicing a question which had been in my mind, "although I am able to use it, I cannot claim really to understand its operation. Could you explain it a little?" They glanced from one to another, and then laughed. I realized that all present could answer my question and that they had been amused at the courtesy which had prompted each to give the other the opportunity. In fact, as I look back on the entire discussion, I realize how different it was throughout from what happens in our world when two or more people are gathered together. Where we jump in, talk at cross purposes and constantly interrupt the speaker, who should at least be permitted to come to an occasional full stop. These men and women had, in all cases, spoken without interruption from the others, and none had held the floor by sheer force of verbosity. As if by common consent, it was Orthon who answered. "In your world you have what you call radio, and there are many amateur radio operators whom you call hams. These have certain channels on which they are allowed to operate. These channels, which you refer to as ether waves, enable a person in one location to send a message to a person at another instrument in some far distant place. The two can hear one another as clearly as if they were in the same room. At one time such communication would have been considered fantastic by people of the type of mind which now derides an interplanetary origin for our ships. To this kind of mentality, little that has not already been proven to the point of being sold over a counter is conceivable. Thoughts are received and transmitted in exactly the same way as by radio, along certain wavelengths, but minus any instrument. We work directly from brain to brain, and here again distance is no barrier. However, an open and receptive mind is needed for success. Through all the years that you have been sending thoughts to us, we have answered. This has established a solid cable-like connection between us by maintaining the thought waves in a single channel. Whenever your mind is open, we can send you the information you require, exactly as you could receive a message over a telephone. You were chosen to meet with me in the presence of witnesses to confirm your experience. We wanted the truth of this meeting to reach as far as possible. And we commend the staff of one of your nation's newspapers which proved brave enough to publish the first account. But one thing which we want you to make clear to all is that mental contacts we have been discussing are definitely not what your people call psychic or spiritualistic, but direct messages from one mind to another. Explanation of what you call psychic will be given you at another time. We call this mental telepathy a unified state of consciousness between two points, the sender and the receiver, and it is the method of communication most commonly used on our planets, especially on planet Venus. Messages can be conveyed between individuals on our planet, from our planet to our spacecraft wherever they may be, and from planet to planet. As I said before, and let me make this firm in your memory, space or distance, as you call it, is no barrier whatsoever. While Orthon was talking, Almuth had unobtrusively gone out of the room. Now she returned with a tray on which were goblets holding what proved to be the same refreshing drink I have described before. After she had distributed the glasses, I said, "About these people from other planets who are living amongst us. Has that been going on for long?" It was Kalner who answered, "Since time immemorial. Or at least," she corrected herself, "for the past 2,000 years. After the crucifixion of Jesus, who was sent to be incarnated on your world to help your people, as had others before him, we decided to carry on our mission in a way less perilous to those concerned than actual birth on your planet. This was made possible by the great advance in our space traveling ships. We were able to bring volunteers in their physical bodies. These men are carefully trained for their mission and receive instructions in regard to their personal safety. Their identity is never revealed except, rarely, to one or another individual for a definite purpose, as with you. They mingle with their earthly brothers to learn their languages and their ways. Then they return to their home planets where they pass on to us what knowledge they have gathered of your world. We have a history of Earth and the happenings thereon dating back 78 million years. Similar histories which were made by men on Earth have been lost with the civilizations that destroyed themselves, the same pattern of destruction that threatens you today. The thing you call war has not existed anywhere else in our system for millions of years. Of course, all planets and their people must pass through the orderly stages of evolvement from lower to higher. But yours has not been an orderly or natural progress, rather, an endless repetition of growth and destruction. Growth and destruction. There have been Earthmen who have left your planet with our help, in order that they might learn from us and, in time, return to their earthly home and pass their knowledge on to you. But under the conditions existing on your planet today, it is no longer possible to do this, since none could be returned. They could not explain where they had been without being branded as lunatics and confined in a mental institution. Nor, in your present world of multiple identification papers, would the sudden return of someone who had mysteriously disappeared long before be unchallenged by the authorities. We cannot subject fellow beings to a prosecution beyond their endurance. This may give you an even clearer understanding of how, in so many ways, we find ourselves blocked by those we so long to help." All the natural gaiety of Kalner's expression had been obliterated by one of sadness as she told me these things. Now, as she took her goblet from the low table and sipped from it, she smiled. As she set the glass back, she said, "It is a great pity that we must talk of such sorrowful things, and still sadder that such woe exists anywhere in the universe. In ourselves, we of other planets are not sad people. We are very joyous. We laugh a great deal." I found myself deeply moved by this little apology. They were joyful people on their planets. Yet they were willing to share the sadness of our Earth, and to strive ceaselessly through the centuries to bring us light. "We still have one hope left," Almuth said, as though trying to cheer me. "We can still come amongst you, and now and again we can make the kind of contact as with you. While your airmen make our landings difficult at present, we are hoping that, When more and more of your people have seen our ships, become accustomed to them and accepted the truth of living beings on other planets, personal meetings with Earth people can be increased. I cannot see how it could be otherwise, I agreed. We all drank from our glasses. As I looked at my friends, I saw that all signs of the concern they felt about conditions on planet Earth had been banished from their faces. I knew that this was wise and right and, trying to follow their example, I asked, "Do you dance and sing on other planets, and have parties as we do?" "We dance a great deal, all of us," Kalna answered. "We consider training the body in a coordination of rhythmic movement an essential part of our education. Moreover, this expression is a part of what you would call our religious ritual. As the poetic form in words can suggest deep feeling not possible to the prose form, so it is with the perfect rhythm expressed in the movement of a body dedicated in a dance of worship. We also dance sheerly for pleasure as do you, although not exactly in the manner of your present-day dancing," she added with a laugh. "We could derive no joy from the kick, wiggle and hop we have observed on your Earth, during which a man and a woman clutch each other ferociously one moment and fling each other off the next. Our social dancing is usually of a group pattern, although often one or more persons, inspired by the moment or the music, will dance for the rest of us. You have seen fine interpretive dancers on your Earth and therefore know the pleasure it is to watch beautiful movement of a body that is inspired by the spirit within. We also have parties," Almuth said, "although we do not think of them in such terms. With us it is quite simply a matter of inviting our friends to our homes that we may talk or relax together. Many of these are outdoor affairs, on our beaches or in our gardens. Like yours, many of our homes have grounds that are planned with swimming pools and large terraces. I wished that I need never leave these wonderful people." But at just this point, Ram arose and said, "It's bad news, but I fear that I must now return you to Earth." I stood up and tried to bury my regret under the thought of a next time. Farewells were said amidst an atmosphere of gaiety and references to another meeting for us all. No one reminded me to remember all I had been told, nor to apply it properly in my activities on Earth. I was left only with a last impression of beauty and warmth and friendliness, and with the knowledge that once ignorance was lifted from them, the people of my world, too, could grow into the natural heritage of all mankind. As we reached the door leading out into the control room, I paused to look back that I might again imprint on my mind every detail of this lovely room, my friends and, above all, the radiant portrait of ageless life. The little scout had been charged while we were visiting and was now in readiness for our return to Earth. The door was open and together we entered, Ram, Firkin and I. Rani'u went to the controls. The clamp and cable had been removed as we climbed the stairs and, as before, the door silently closed after the last man had entered. Slowly, we slid down the sloping rail, through to airlocks and out again into space through the bottom of the ship. As we descended on the rail, I felt again that sensation of dropping in the pit of my stomach, though it was less intense and of shorter duration than when we entered. It seemed an impossibly short time before the door slid open and Firkin said, "Here we are again, back to Earth." This time the craft was not set down upon the ground, but remained hovering about 6 inches above it. Ramu came forward and extended his hand in farewell, saying, "I shall not be driving in with you as I must remain with the scout. I am glad of this evening with you and look forward to another soon." I echoed his sentiments. The drive back to the hotel was a silent one, full of feeling and deep thoughts on my part. Firkin undoubtedly knew this. He stopped the car in front of my hotel but did not get out. We shook hands and he said, "We shall be meeting again before long." I was wondering when and where, and he answered the unspoken question by saying, "Do not doubt that you will be alerted at the right time, and find yourself in the right place." I stepped out of the car. Raising his hand in farewell, Firkin drove away, leaving me standing there on the sidewalk alone. Entering the hotel, I went to my room. For the first time since leaving with my friends, I looked at my watch. It was 5:10 a.m. I was not in the least sleepy, nor was I aware of any fatigue. I sat on the edge of the bed for a full hour reviewing the experiences of the night. And even as they went through my mind, I could not help but reflect on how fantastic the whole thing would seem to my fellow man. Nevertheless, I felt that I must tell of it. Actually, I myself could scarcely believe in the reality of all that had happened in the past few hours. Yet I knew what my eyes had seen and my ears had heard, and that without doubt it had been a completely physical experience. Finally, slipping out of my clothes, I stretched out and must have fallen into a light sleep. It was close to 8 o'clock when I awakened. I dressed hastily, for there was little time left in which to eat breakfast and catch the bus on which I was to return home. Riding along in the bus, my physical eyes saw the earthly scenery through which we were passing, and some of the people seated in my immediate vicinity. But my mind, absorbed in the experiences of the previous night, was still traveling in space, or with my companions in the giant carrier ship. The feeling of being in two places simultaneously persisted for several weeks. I found it very difficult to return to the bondage of earthly ways. Although the time in which I had been privileged to view the vastness of space and the beauty of its constant action had been short, I carried the wonder of it with me. All that I had learned from these friends of other worlds was not given to me alone, but for the sharing with all on Earth willing to receive it. The scout ship from Saturn time slipped by with no more meetings with my friends from other worlds. Yet often I felt that they were near. It was 2 months later, on April 21st, that I again felt a sudden urge to go to the city. Accordingly, the next day I arranged to be driven to Oceanside, where I caught an early afternoon bus for Los Angeles, which brought me into that city a little more than 2 hours later. I registered in the same hotel as before and went to my room to freshen up after my trip. Then I returned downstairs and went into the cocktail lounge for a little chat with my friend, the bar attendant. Shortly after, I returned to the lobby, bought a weekly news magazine and settled down to wait. This time, the feeling of uncertainty and inner restlessness which had plagued me on the first occasion was entirely absent. I knew the meaning of the urge which had brought me down from the mountains. So I read with interest the reports on both home and foreign events as printed, plus a bit of what is called reading between the lines on my own. Except for the entrance of two men whom I knew slightly, and who came over to exchange a few words, there were no interruptions. Suddenly I looked up, and there stood my Martian friend, Thurkn. I jumped to my feet with what probably could be described only as a broad grin. Thurkn too wore a wide smile, and we exchanged the customary greeting. Then he said a certain word, stressing it in a way which clearly gave to it some particular significance. As we left the hotel together, he said, "The handclasp has been described to a certain extent, and we thought it best to add the word you have just heard as a further identification between you and those of our worlds who are contacting you here. This will be particularly useful in case you are approached by someone strange to you, as will sometimes be the case." "An excellent precaution," I agreed. Then, glancing at my wristwatch and noting that it was already 7:15, I said, "If your plans permit, and you would like something to eat, I know of a little cafe close by where we can sit in a booth and talk undisturbed." "That will fit in perfectly," he said, adding with a smile, "After all, the body too has to be nourished." As we walked along, I asked about Ram. Thurkn told me that he would not be with us tonight. The cafe was full, but we were fortunate in arriving just in time to slip into a booth as the former occupants were leaving. We exchanged greetings with the waitress who came to clear the table. Thurkn glanced briefly at the menu she had given him, then laid it aside and ordered a peanut butter sandwich on whole wheat bread, black coffee and a piece of apple pie. "I'll take the same," I said. When we were left alone, he began speaking quietly. "I see that, reading along in that magazine, you were struck by the volume of suspicion, antagonism and hatred which groups of men on your Earth are continuously fostering against other groups. Since I had not been consciously thinking of this after Furkin's arrival, I was somewhat amazed that he was aware of my reaction." "Quite simple," he explained. "It is still a very powerful thought picture in what you might call the back of your mind. Few people," he went on, "recognize those destructive emotions within themselves for what they are. Even those who pride themselves on possessing mild dispositions. Yet notice what a small incident is necessary to cause a man to lose his temper. In a while, with a little more aggravation, he enters the fighting stage and becomes aggressive in what he calls self-protection. Actually, this is nothing but a state of emotional unbalance that carries with it a force of fury that sheds all reason. Once recognized, such habit patterns can be curbed, or even broken entirely. At this point our food was brought. As we were left alone again he continued, "Responsibility for the state of affairs existing on Earth today cannot be blamed on only a few in any nation. In my business and social contacts with my Earth brothers I have encountered many saturated with these destructive emotions and encased in egotism. Naturally, fear and confusion are prevalent. A few have succeeded in developing a higher consideration for their fellow men by seeking to learn more of the universal laws. Some have chosen the channels of what you call metaphysics, occultism and other similar names. But amongst these there is often a selfish motive toward self-promotion and personal gain rather than the universal motive of service to others and mutual welfare. As a result of such general self-seeking, it makes little difference whom the people may choose as leaders, even if selected from their own ranks. Leaders are subject to the habits of the majority where the majority is in power. We of other worlds who have been living unrecognized amongst you can see clearly how identity with divine origin has been lost. People of Earth have become separate entities which are no longer truly human in expression as in the beginning they were. Now they are but slaves of habit. Nonetheless, imprisoned within these habits is still the original soul that yearns for expression according to its divine inheritance. This smothered urge is bound to disturb deeply the man chained to his ruts by the mechanism of habit. And this is why, desiring finer and greater expression, more often than men realize, something stirring within the depths of their beings leaves the habit-bound self uneasy and restless. Yet the habit is so powerful in its accumulation that while man wants to listen to this kind, wise voice, he fears to yield, not knowing where it might lead him. However, until man can cast off the shackles of his personal self-pride and allow this voice to guide him, he will continue to live as a warrior against the laws of his own being. As you know, so long as men do not desire to change their way of living, none can help them. Those few on earth who do sincerely desire to learn the laws of the Infinite One must try to lead the others. And we of other worlds will help them. We had lingered over our meal while Firkin talked. Now he rose from the booth. Outside again, we walked about 2 blocks to where the same Pontiac was parked at the curb. It was a blustery night, but I scarcely noticed the storm. During the first part of our journey, my mind was revolving around what Firkin had been saying. Toward the end, I could think only of what new adventures might be mine tonight. The drive from the city seemed shorter this time to the point where, as before, we suddenly turned off the main highway. This time we drove only a short distance before the car stopped. At first I could make out nothing except the outline of a few low hills to my right and, as far as I could see in the darkness, level terrain in all other directions. Although I felt certain that it was intended we should meet the scout again, I could see no sign of it nor any light that might reveal its presence. However, my companion seemed sure of his direction and we walked along for quite some time before the low hills came to a sudden end. There, in the distance, I could make out a gentle glow. My anticipation increased as we set off toward this light and, after about a quarter of a mile or so, the familiar outline of the scout became visible. But something was different. This was much larger than the little craft I had in my memory. This one must have been over 100 feet in diameter, with larger portals and a much flatter dome. A figure was standing silhouetted against the glow of the ship whom at first I took to be my Venusian friend, wearing the now familiar ski-type pilot's suit. But this pilot proved to be a stranger, a handsome man about 6 feet tall. He came forward a few steps and greeted us in a warm and friendly manner, while giving the usual hand clasp. I shall call him Sol. I was wondering if this enormous saucer was a Martian craft when the pilot corrected my thought by saying, "This scout is from Saturn, and it too is carried in a large carrier or mothership such as the one you have already been in." He turned, led us to the waiting saucer, whose door was already open, and entered. I followed, Firkin behind me. This ship was at least 4 times the diameter of the Venusian scout and about twice as high, possibly a little more. The door closed in the same silent way behind Firkin. Instantly the light within increased and the low humming became audible as the machinery started. I felt a slight tug or jerk, not enough to unbalance me, and I guessed that we had left the Earth. As I gazed around, trying to take stock of my new surroundings, the Saturnian pilot explained that this ship was not only larger than the little scout, but differed in other respects. It had not been hovering above the ground, but was set down firmly on its huge three-ball undercarriage. What I had felt was the jerk necessary to make the break with Earth. Azul gave, as an analogy, a piece of iron clinging to a magnet. A jerk takes place at the instant of separation. As I looked around, I saw the familiar bluish-white diffused light and the same kind of glassy translucent metal walls. On either side was a curved passage about 4 feet wide, which appeared to encircle the ship. On the outer wall of this passage I noticed a group of portals, considerably larger than those in the small ship and, from what I could see, I judged there must be 4 such groups in all, 1 group in each quadrant. Ahead, a corridor of the same apparent width, with high walls that reached up into the dome, ran straight forward for about 1/3 of the ship's diameter. Beyond this there seemed to be a central chamber in which I could see a large magnetic pole placed through the center of the ship. The pilot then asked me if I would care to go on a tour of the scout while it was in flight. Needless to say, I would. Leading the way, Azul took me into the central chamber, an amazing sight. It is difficult to describe anything so unfamiliar and complicated after seeing it for the first time. However, I shall do my best. In plan, the ship resembled a wheel. The 4 corridors were like 4 spokes leading to the hub or central chamber in which we now stood. The walls ranged 20 to 30 feet from floor to ceiling. They were covered almost entirely by illuminated graphs and charts, over which lines and geometric shapes wove the intricate patterns in continually changing colors that had fascinated me in the Venusian scout. Beautiful to watch, these held me equally enthralled, although I could understand them no better. About halfway up around the circular walls ran a delicate metal balcony, reached by a ladder. Above the walls was the translucent dome itself, surmounted by an enormous telescopic lens. Almost the entire floor space was taken up by an equally gigantic lens, at least twice the diameter of the one in the Venusian ship. Around this were 4 curved benches on which observers could sit and gaze down through space at the planet beneath. But the central magnetic pole, running from floor to dome, dominated the entire chamber. This huge silent rod of power, passing through the 2 great lenses, contained the secrets we yearn for, the secrets of interplanetary fight. As I have indicated, the ship was divided into 4 quadrants by the 4 radial corridors. These corridors entered the central chamber by 4 openings. Turning to our left, we now walked along one of the corridors. About halfway down its length we came upon 2 large archways opposite each other in the corridor walls. The pilot led me through the right-hand arch into a part of the ship which he described as the crew's sleeping quarters. This whole quadrant was divided in an interesting manner. In front of us were about 12 small private rooms or cubicles where each member of the crew had his private sleeping place. I did not go into any of them, but as all the doors were open, I was able to see how perfectly and compactly they were equipped, in a manner our Pullman train engineers might envy. A kind of ship's ladder with handrails ran up to a section immediately over the sleeping quarters. This, I believe, was the only part of the ship to contain 2 complete decks within 1 quadrant. Up here was a kind of dormitory or restroom, equipped with couches and deep comfortable chairs where the crew could rest or converse. The ceiling of this apartment was formed entirely by the slope of the translucent dome, and it reminded me of a dreamlike solarium. Certainly it must have been a lovely way of relaxing, under the huge curved glassy dome with stars and space out beyond. While taking all this in, I wondered how many crew members there were. Normally 12 men comprise a full crew, said Zell, but at the moment there are only 2 men on board beside myself, since no more are necessary for a short trip like this. Then I wondered whether all the members of this particular crew were Saturnians, since it was a Saturnian ship. This thought was corrected when Zell said, although this scout was built on Saturn, no particular planet owns it. Instead, we share it. Consequently, its crew has members from all planets.